It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we want to talk about palliative care. Now, people often confuse palliative care with hospice. In fact, the care you are given in hospice includes palliative care. That is, care that makes you as comfortable as possible for the time that's left. Hospice care focuses on a person's last months of life, when curing a patient is no longer an option. Unlike hospice, palliative care can be performed for non-terminal patients. It is, in fact, to help people live longer, happier lives. My guest this half hour is Dr. M.R. Rajagopal. He is a 2018 Nobel Peace Prize finalist, a native of India. He is both a palliative care physician and an anesthesiologist. He was named one of the 30 most influential leaders in hospice and palliative care by the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. He kickstarted the first university-approved graduate program in his home country, India, in pain and palliative medicine. And he was a key part of the formation of the Pain and Palliative Care Society back in 1993. There's a feature-length film about him, Hippocratic. It follows the life of Dr. Rajagopal and his dream of creating a pain-free India.
Doctors have to care. This is what palliative care is about. But hello? I truly believe that this is what healthcare as a whole should be about. About building lives, not about destroying lives. In the developing world, the profit-making industry goes unchecked. The way medical science is progressing, there is a tendency for doctors to be human machines, diagnosing diseases and attacking the disease. Somewhere, medical practice lost a bit of the heart. It's all brain.
Dr. M.R. Rajagopal joins me in the studio now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for this privilege.
So tell us, we heard a little bit of the trailer from the film about you. What is...
Somehow, the application of science can destroy human health. I make that statement deliberately.
The application of science can destroy human health. That's a curious statement. How?
Health is defined by World Health Organization as not only absence of disease or infirmity, but physical, social, and mental well-being. Do you think that's what the medical system is doing today? The medical science does imaging, diagnosis, and offers curative treatment. In the process, if the person is feeling depressed, if his relationships are broken, he cannot be healthy. So healthcare has to include the psychosocial domain also. Do you know that according to World Bank reports, more than 800 million people worldwide are subject to catastrophic health expenditure? In my country of India alone, in a single year, 55 million people are pushed below poverty line by out-of-pocket healthcare costs. If more than 800 million globally are subject to that catastrophic health expenditure, then what is healthcare achieving?
Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you or a loved one have an illness that can be helped or remedied by technology or a medicine, you want to pay that cost, right? What is the alternative?
The alternative would be twofold. One, there should be some check on healthcare industry. I ask you, what is the purpose of any industry? What's the objective? It is to make profit, right?
Right, yeah.
And when it happens to be about healthcare industry, if it can make more profit out of my suffering, it is more successful, right? Where does a check, where does a balance come in?
Mm-hmm.
In the attempts to generate more profit, my health can be compromised. Now, look, I am talking about the bad side. Very clearly, we must look on the good side. Medical science has progressed. It has the ability to cure my diseases. If it is cancer, my chance of cure is twice as good today than it was a quarter of a century back. I'm not discounting that fact. I'm only saying that application of curative medicine should be tempered with compassion and concern for health. The answer for that expense means that either it has to be socialized medicine, as is available in most of Western Europe, or an effective insurance system which reaches out to the population. That's not happening. The socialized medicine or insurance system reaches only 20% of the global population.
20%.
Only 20%. And the same system we apply to the other 80% at the same cost, and naturally destroys families. So, yes, if my family member is ill, I should get proper treatment. I should give them proper treatment. I'll find the money. But somewhere, my nurse and my doctor should help me to understand what's being done, what's the purpose of the treatment, and help me to make realistic choices.
Can you give me an example, Dr. Rajagopal, of an instance? Take a patient, perhaps one that you have had, or create an instance, an example for us, so that we get a better idea of what you're talking about. A patient comes in with some kind of disease. In one instance, they're treated one way. In another instance, they're treated in the way that you feel, the direction you feel should we go. Give us a concrete example of what you mean so we can better understand that, please.
Imagine the man of a family getting cancer. It happens out of the blue. The diagnosis of cancer comes in. And he goes to the cancer hospital. The medical system is typically paternalistic. It would give the man the choice between, okay, here is what we think you should do. You should have this radiation. When the tumor shrinks, we'll operate on you. And you may have to follow that up with chemotherapy. Right? That's all that happens. And by the time that treatment is over, then he recognizes that treatment was never expected to be curative. It was only to prolong his life. Now, what I think should happen is the initial evaluation should not only include the size of my tumor. It should find out maybe a social worker talking to me for 10 minutes. Who are all there in the family? How much can we afford? And then either the doctor or somebody in the system should tell me whether my disease is curable. If I go through this treatment, will I get cured? Will I be able to get back to work? Because if I am told, if you do all that, we have a good chance of your life being prolonged by 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then it is my choice. I can then say, look, for that extension of 6 months of life, I do not want to destroy my family. Don't do that radiation surgery and chemo. Give me palliative care. Let me spend some time in comfort with my family. That choice should be given to me.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying this scenario that you painted happens in your country, in India, in other countries, and also here in the United States, where families, a life is prolonged by however many months, but then a family is left to pay a debt for years?
Ben, I do not really know your medical system well. I have not worked here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of support is given to the family to make informed choices. But I know that in 80% of the world, that would be my world, the global south, those choices are not given. I wonder whether even in your country or in the UK or Germany or Australia, people get enough support to make informed choices, sit together and talk, understand the purpose of treatment, help. I need help at that time to come to a state of acceptance because I am scared of cancer. And if I don't follow your advice, doctor, you are God. If I don't follow your advice, I would be in trouble. I would say whatever, I would do whatever you say. But I expect that you will give me the right advice and give me the choices.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Dr. M.R. Rajagopal, a 2018 Nobel Peace Prize finalist. Native of India, he is a palliative care physician and anesthesiologist, has done a lot of work in the area of hospice and palliative care. In fact, he was named one of the 30 most influential leaders in hospice and palliative care by the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. As a palliative care physician, Dr. Rajagopal, you're dealing with pain. What are our tools to deal with pain? Are opioids our only tools?
Thank you for asking that question. By no means, opioids will not help all kinds of pain. Generally, opioids are effective only in about 2/3 of all pains. And we have to understand what pain is. Pain, by definition, is not only a sensation, it's an emotional experience. For the same tumor or for the same injury, if I know I am well cared for, my suffering will be less. If I am anxious, agitated, mm-hmm. depressed, my experience of pain will be more. So treatment of pain should not only be with medicines, it should be also with explanations, assurance, reassurance about what can be done. And the medicines are not only opioids, they belong to different groups, and it's about understanding the type of pain and often using the right combination of medicines. Mm-hmm. Something that happened earlier in this century, globally, and certainly in USA, was somehow projecting the idea that opioids are things that will treat all kinds of pain and that they are harmless. There should certainly be a balance. Doctors and nurses have to learn to assess pain properly and use the right combination of medicines. They have to learn to use opioids and also to avoid opioids when it should be avoided. Mm-hmm. We talk about the principle of balance, that we have the duty to make sure that pain is relieved. We also have the duty to make sure that opioids are not abused.
This is interesting, back to the nature of pain, that it is not something that is, I guess, measurable or quantifiable as easily as one might think, like the temperature today is 90 degrees or it's 50 degrees or something like that. We know what the temperature is outside on any given day. But you're saying pain is different depending on your emotional state, on the anxiety or the comfort you're feeling, the relationship you have with your family and friends who are around you?
Absolutely. So what am I saying? I'm saying that recognizing that pain is also an emotional experience is something that the medical system should do, because then it will not be only mindless prescription of medicines. he'll be taking into consideration the person's background also. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, as you said, pain is subjective. The only person who can measure to some extent is the person who goes through the pain. So we ask them to measure the pain. On a scale, 0 means no pain, 10 is the worst imaginable pain. And then if I say it, say it now, and you give me the medication, and I say that it has come down to 3, then you know whether it has been effective. And if the person is anxious, the same therapist should look at the anxiety. Tell me, you seem a bit anxious. Would you like to talk to me about it? And then the person may say, Doctor, I know I am dying. This is going to kill me. And then you may be able to explain that actually your disease is getting better and such things are happening. And my pain experience may become better and my requirement of medicines will be actually less.
If we look at this through purely an economic window, the economics around the world, in any of the countries dealing with chronic pain, what is the cost to our society of dealing with pain, long-term pain, the way we do now? What could be the difference that we could make employing some of the ideas that you've suggested?
Chronic pain has to be taken not only as a medical issue, but as you say, it's also a psychosocial issue. So it's about helping the whole person, not treating the pain alone. If no support is given to them, then they may get more frustrated and their drug abuse levels may be higher. And then we will pay an enormous cost to treat him in an intensive care unit. By not investing enough in psychosocial support and holistic treatment of pain, we are not really saving money. Mm-hmm. We are wasting money inappropriately by unrealistic, unnecessary critical care.
Mm-hmm. Back to this very interesting idea of pain as a subjective feeling. If I am diagnosed with a terminal illness and you as my doctor come to me and tell me these are the things we can do medically for you and then the costs associated with them, I imagine, do you have people who are, of course, devastated by the news that they may have cancer or whatever, but then the extra burden of knowing if they take one path, they will be burdening their family long after they're gone. That adds to pain?
That certainly adds to the pain and suffering. So let me add a bit more to what you said the doctor should offer. If, as I am sitting there as a patient, in addition to giving me the diagnosis and the cost of treatment, the doctor also tells me, with his words, but more with his eyes and his facial expression, that he truly cares for me and conveys to me, look, I see you are troubled. I am here to help you. We will help you to come to the best decisions. Here is the problem, and these are the alternatives. And then comes the cost, not as a blunt fact. There are expensive modalities of treatment, and this will help you maybe to live an average of 3 months longer. But if you do not go that route, we would still help you to live as comfortably as possible. Tell me, what is it that you want to do with your life? He acknowledges me as a person, and he helped me to achieve what I want to.
And you as a doctor are tuned in, he is tuned into your eyes and your facial expression, but you are tuned into his face. What are you looking for in a reaction to know that you are successful in this way as a doctor?
I am successful if I have done my best. I also have to realize that I cannot solve all problems. But the person may look visibly relieved and may ask me a dozen questions. And the very fact that he is asking those questions tells me that I have been successful, at least partially.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose palliative care as your area of medicine?
I didn't. I think it sort of chose me. I mean, I am an anesthetist by profession, and I started treating pain. And it was my patients who taught me that people are more than one symptom or nerves to be blocked. And I came across palliative care because the patients taught me that I should look at people as a whole and not only look at a disease.
As we end this conversation, Dr. Rajagopal, I want to ask you about a unique program that is a partnership between the University of Iowa and your home country, India. The UI India Winterim is a three-week program that provides students with the opportunity to learn on-site in India. And I understand there is a Winterim course, Pain and Palliative Care, Learning from Each Other. Your visit here is due to that course, and you've been meeting with students here to exchange ideas?
Oh, yes, indeed. And the partnership with the University of Iowa is something that we value greatly. Every year, a group of students, anywhere from 12 to 20, come to India for 3 weeks. It's called a cultural immersion program. They learn that people in many parts of the world do not live exactly the way Americans live. They see the hardships, they see the negatives and positives, and we learn from them also. It's an exchange, really. They help us. They help us with various projects. So for us, it has been a very fruitful partnership. And as I have been meeting the students, and that has been a delightful experience.
We want to thank you very much. 2018 Nobel Peace Prize finalist Dr. M.R. Rajagopal, thank you for stopping into our studio during your visit to the United States and to Iowa.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, a conversation with Dr. Ann Broderick of the VA Medical Center in Iowa City. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if you were with us this last half hour, a great discussion with Dr. Rajagopal, a 2018 Nobel Peace Prize finalist. He's a palliative care physician and an anesthesiologist who was touring here in Iowa not too long ago, and I had that discussion when he was here in Iowa. Wanted to sort of localize this conversation, find out more about palliative care on an Iowa scale, what's happening in our Iowa public radio community. Joining us to do that, Dr. Ann Broderick is Director of Hospice and Palliative Care at the VA Medical Center in Iowa City. Dr. Broderick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
You have about 25 years of experience in this area, palliative care and hospice. And when we left Dr. Raj, as he is known, in our last half hour, he was talking about this interesting cooperation between the University of Iowa and India, the India Winterim, and one course there focuses on pain and palliative care. I'd like to have you comment about the trading ideas with India so that students here, Americans, can learn.
It is a great collaboration between Pallium India and the College of Nursing, International Programs and the College of Pharmacy, and the College of Arts and Sciences, where they send anywhere between 10, 20 students, usually pre-health professionals or health professional students, who express an interest in palliative care to go and experience what palliative care is, sometimes for the first time, in an environment that has very low resources. Dr. Rajagopal is a a consummate teacher. He teaches at the bedside with high compassion, never stands near a patient, always sits down so that he's eye to eye, and has a wealth of experience in how to treat pain in an environment where, until recently, morphine and other opioids were not even available. So they treat pain, I would say, holistically. They address the social aspects of pain. For students from the University of Iowa to see the social determinants of health in such crystallized ways on home visits, hiking through rubber plantations, it is life-altering. I think it's some of the best education that anybody can get at the University of Iowa.
Dr. Broderick, also because we have a few new listeners, since we talked about what palliative care is, how do you define it? What's a short way to think about it?
I define it every day when I meet patients, because frequently they're afraid to meet me, fearful that I'm going to talk about death only. It is the newest medical specialty designed to help people navigate through a complex healthcare system, treat symptoms, and maybe most importantly, make sure that their voice is heard and documented in the medical record. So what's important to them is first and foremost when we do shared decision making. An example might be a patient who says the most important thing to him is to be able to walk his daughter down the aisle at her wedding, mm-hmm. a wedding that might be coming up in 6 months. Our goal, therefore, as palliative care physicians, is to make sure that all specialties are aware that this is the very most important thing. And what can we do to deliver this goal for this patient and family?
And when you have a situation like that, a situation where you would, on the one hand, perhaps ignore that or put that as a lower priority, or give it a high priority, that going to a wedding like that, what difference does that make in terms of the experience that person has of pain?
So I think what we don't realize is that pain is not a purely physical symptom. So when you address goals, anxieties, fears by front on asking what people worry about most, this patient might have been worried about whether or who was going to walk his daughter down the aisle. Putting it front and center means that his anxiety is less and his pain is less. Mm. Anxiety is it frequently amplifies physical pain. Fear amplifies physical pain. When we address fear and anxiety, we often decrease pain. We see this every day with Raj's work. I call him Raj. He is Dr. Rajagopal. By dealing with the social determinants of health and the social determinants of pain, he decreases pain on a regular basis. When we do home visits, we deliver food. Children have their education paid for by Pallium India, because that is such a source of high anxiety for families.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about palliative care in this country and how it is so new, that term is something that most people aren't even acquainted with. I'm sure you run into that all the time talking with people. What is palliative care? How many people in this country, or whatever numbers you can provide us, could benefit from palliative care that aren't? How far do we have to go here to really reap the benefits of palliative care?
So I think our goal nationwide and here in Iowa City is to make sure that all healthcare personnel can use palliative care principles in their work, understanding pain and assessing pain, understanding what the goals are, sitting down and being eye level and trying to get to know patients. We want everybody to be primary palliative care practitioners, there's not enough of us to have these conversations. Heart failure alone, 300,000 people die every year. There simply are not enough palliative care physicians to have those conversations.
So let's talk about heart failure, a case of heart failure. What difference can that make specifically if we talk about medical care without palliative care and with integrated palliative care? Give me the difference there.
We have great data to show that when palliative care is involved in heart failure, patients are caught earlier. When we intervene in several ways, we can intervene with visiting nurses who help them get their daily weights, who get medicines to help intervene. We can also intervene in some situations with hospice. And sure enough, as soon as we get high quality home care in to see patients, their heart failure symptoms decrease, and they no longer have to go to the emergency room and be admitted every single time. So it's not uncommon for a patient who has very, very hard, bad heart failure, multiple admissions, monthly admissions to the hospital, if they get a hospice intervention with that high-quality, multidisciplinary care, they no longer go to the hospital. Mm. In fact, sometimes they get discharged. They, quote, graduate from hospice because that intense home system of support has given them a new life, shall we say. The hospice paradox, which is that they get better as soon as hospice gets involved.
If you just joined us, Dr. Ann Broderick is my guest this half hour. She's director of hospice and palliative care at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Iowa City. Decades of experience dealing in the field of hospice and palliative care. A specialized form of medicine, medical care for people with life-limiting illnesses, focusing on what? Relief from symptoms of the pain, the physical stress, and the mental stress that any illness can bring us. So palliative care, we should think about as the larger umbrella above hospice care?
I like to explain that palliative care is really appropriate as soon as a patient is diagnosed with a serious illness which might lead to their death. Not because they're imminently dying, but because they need to know what choices they have and how to make clear what their wishes are and what their values are, in addition to having symptoms well controlled. And sometimes we get involved in a patient very early at the time of diagnosis, and we're not involved for years until that patient needs more support.
Mm-hmm. How widespread is palliative care, the things that you're trying to do in Iowa hospitals?
You're asking a specific question that I can't have a very specific answer for, but increasingly hospitals in Iowa have palliative care practitioners. Here in this town, we have the University Hospitals has a very strong palliative care program. The VA has a palliative care program. And Mercy Hospital, the hospitalists operate as the palliative care team.
Am I wrong, Dr. Broderick, in thinking that palliative care is something of a, I guess, oddball is the way the word I'll choose, even though that's not the correct word, in that all of medicine is focused on getting people well, in overcoming illnesses and making things right again, in a recovery. But palliative care is not that. Is it set off in a different way because of that?
It is, because rather than focusing on an organ and an organ dysfunction or disease, we try to focus on whole health, the health that comes from being healthy emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, relation, and in your relationships. So it is different that we're not focused on disease as much as we're focused on the patient.
Mm-hmm. Is there controversy among physicians, your colleagues, doctors in Iowa, the degree to which palliative care should be part of the picture?
Well, of course. I think early on, my colleagues and even my mentors would maybe even avert their eyes when they saw me. This is no longer the case. I'm a welcome member of the hospital staff. Welcome because of the skills that I can bring in communication mm-hmm. and in symptom management.
Avert their eyes. Why? What would have been on their head?
I think when you are a physician who focuses on curing disease, mm-hmm. My mere presence might have represented the reality that they won't always be successful. It's all over, but it was in those early days walking in the halls. It wasn't universal acceptance among my peers. Things are changing. Education on palliative care are high presence for the medical school, pharmacy school, and nursing. Nursing is making changes with upcoming generations.
And when you say the early days, stretching back to when you began in this field in the 1990s,
those are the early days. I think all of us would, who go back that far, remember that we weren't always welcome at the table.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ann Broderick, my guest, Director of Hospice and Palliative Care at the VA Medical Center in Iowa City. What would you say to listeners here saying, boy, this sounds interesting, maybe a loved one, maybe myself, mm-hmm. might be interested in finding out more about palliative care to see if it's something that applies to my situation or the situation of a loved one? What's the way to approach that as someone seeking medical care?
I would suggest the website called getpalliativecare.org because it is run with good information about where palliative care is available. In most cases, you can ask your primary care provider to refer you for palliative care for those conversations. But in many cases, a person's palliative care provider would be able to talk about palliative care principles. I think all of us over the age of 18 should have designated who would make decisions if we were unable to make decisions. I like telling the residents that while I feel healthy, I sometimes take risks, like riding a bike home in the middle of a tornado watch. That could have been disastrous, mm-hmm. And somebody would need to speak for me. We all need to designate who makes decisions if we're unable to make decisions, and we need to give direction to those designees, those surrogates, what is most important to us.
What would you like to see, Dr. Broderick, in terms of public policy, in terms of perhaps legislation that would further awareness, perhaps further training among medical staff, physicians?
This is a very exciting time to be a palliative care physician because right now we just passed through large advocacy on the part of us nationwide, passed a legislation through the House, through Congress, and is now sitting in Senate committee, a Palliative Care and Hospice Education Training Act. I think I got that right.
Okay.
This is designed to help increase education research in the way in palliative care. While I think this is exciting, I have to say, Ben, that the real palliative care is going to happen when communities start asking for something different. We have an epidemic of loneliness. It happens in nursing homes.
Dr. Raj spoke about that as well.
Yes. It is not unique to India, for sure. It's happening more in India now because they now have more nuclear families, especially in his native state of Kerala, where people, children, are frequently exported to the Gulf states or to the United States. The loneliness that people experience is often geographic loneliness, but it's also the loneliness of not being understood. So loneliness comes in many, many ways. And I think more and more we as communities need to reach out to neighbors, reach out in our communities. Dr. Raj works with community organizations that simply look for need. They become case managers in their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. We have a vastly different picture in terms of our health system in this country than Dr. Raj has in India. Talk a little bit about how palliative care is funded in this country and what funding is looking like now and what you see in the future.
So palliative care largely is funded at large hospitals, not because we see so many patients, but because hospitals see it as a critical part of healthcare, that we treat symptoms and address shared decision-making when patients, especially when patients are in the hospital. Palliative care in the United States is increasingly provided by hospices in the communities. They sometimes see that while a patient is not ready or even appropriate for hospice, they can provide palliative care sort of as a pre-hospice motif. I'd like to give a shout out to the VA, which actually funds palliative care as part of its integrated mission-based healthcare system. The VA is the largest educational and research healthcare system in the country. This is not celebrated very often, but what it means is that the VA, as a funder, can provide far more integrated health, addressing social determinants of health. They look in a far more integrative way because their funding is more mission-based and integrated. It's been a very exciting year since I've been at the VA. They are more innovative than I even knew until I got my feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm. You've been working in this field, palliative care, hospice care, for 25 years, a quarter century. If you look, let's just look a quarter century into the future. What's your vision of where we should be? Describe the healthcare as it should be with palliative care integrated.
Well, Dr. Raj would say that we need to put both health and care back into healthcare. And I think the ways we need to do that is to address the social determinants of health. The ability of somebody to buy their medicines, have a roof over their head, not be lonely. These are ways that we need to move forward. Healthcare cannot be disease-directed and ignore the soul and heart of the patient. And what I hope is that we'll get to know patients in their entirety. We call it whole health. This is my vision is that we will treat total pain and treat the whole patient and the concentric circles around them, their family and their community. I think it's possible in 25 years. I think we know that our disease-directed mechanisms are not working. We're simply admitting, discharging. This is definitely true in heart failure and lung disease. We could be doing things very much differently in their communities, and that's where patients want to be.
Dr. Ann Broderick, Director of Hospice and Palliative Care at the VA Medical Center in Iowa City, thank you for really giving us a good picture of this new field of medicine, palliative care. We appreciate it, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And that does it for today's program. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of this program, River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.